Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the January 14th session of the Portland City Council. Before we begin our official proceedings, today I'm very pleased to proclaim via my first ever mayoral proclamation, Radon Action Month. And if Marlene and Beverly and Don would please come forward, take a seat at the dais. Marlene McGowan is from Lake Oswego, and her spouse died at the age of 49 from radon. She is headed to Washington, D.C. as a radon activist guest of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. Very sorry for your loss and glad that you're here to fight for this issue. Beverly Stewart is of the American Lung Association, and Don Francis is from Ecotech, a great local green and sustainability business located here in Portland. Let me read the proclamation, and then I'd turn it over to you for making some brief comments on the issue. Whereas radon is colorless, odorless, radioactive gas that causes an estimated 21,000 lung cancer deaths in the United States each year, and whereas levels of radon above the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency recommended action level may be found in any home in Portland, and whereas nearly half the homes in some Portland neighborhoods have radon levels above the EPA recommended action levels, and whereas Portland residents are at risk of contracting lung cancer from elevated radon levels in their homes, and whereas testing for radon is simple and inexpensive, and whereas radon problems can be fixed, and whereas the American Lung Association, the Oregon Department of Human Services, and the U.S. EPA recommend that all houses be tested for radon, have elevated levels of radons reduced, and have new homes built with radon-resistant features, now, therefore, I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, does hereby declaim January 2009 as Radon Action Month and encourage all residents to test their homes for radon. And I'm going to be doing that. Who would like to go first?
I would. Okay. Good morning. Thank you, Mayor Sam Adams and Commissioners. My name is Bev Stewart with the American Lung Association of Oregon. I am the Lung Health Manager. And on behalf of the American Lung Association, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to promote radon awareness in Portland. Radon is the leading cause of lung cancer for non-smokers, and lung cancer kills more people than breast, colon, and prostate cancers combined. The fact that there's such a low knowledge base of the need to test your home for radon is hugely evident when I talk to people on the street or even people who are in the end stages of lung cancer and didn't know that they should test their homes for radon to keep themselves and their family safe. So I thank you for that. The American Lung Association mission is to save lives by preventing lung disease and promoting lung health. And this proclamation is doing that. It's saving lives by preventing lung disease. So I appreciate your time, and we're happy to stand with you and proclaim that everyone should test their homes for radon. Thank you.
Thank you. Marlene?
I'm Marlene McEwen, and in July of 2003, my late husband was diagnosed with lung cancer as a non-smoker. It had been in his system for 2 years at that time. There was no kind of warning sign whatsoever. He was woke up one morning with a lump on his neck and went to the doctor, thought it was a lymph node. It ended up being a lymph node, but not a viral kind of infection in his lymph node. All the cancer testing came back as negative, and it wasn't until they did a chest x-ray and found a major tumor in the right lower lobe of his lung that it was diagnosed as lung cancer. And I called the EPA and asked them what we should do, and they said, you know, that they asked me where we lived, and I said, like Oswego, and they said, you don't even need to test because your whole area is usually about 1.8, and of course anything under 4 is considered an acceptable risk. We went ahead and tested, and I called them with the results, which came back at 57.2. Wow. And they were in shock and said, please test again. And we did, and it came back at the same. So we went ahead and called back the EPA, and they were very helpful at that point and got us in contact with Don, and Don did our mitigation system, which was able to bring our home back down to safe levels of 2.1. which was pretty amazing, actually. This is a home that my father built in 1948 that I grew up in, that I've had exposure to my entire 54 years of my life. And my husband had moved there in 1991. We had purchased it from my parents and had no idea that the radon level was this high. So I want to thank you for your proclamation. It's very important to me, and I have taken up the cause of becoming a radon advocate for testing and public awareness on this issue. It's very, very important. It seems that people really, we told our neighbors, and some of them decided to test and some didn't. Some want to know and some don't. But I think it's important that you, Mayor Adams, and the council members take a lead in this and be able to show our community, not only Portland, but the rest of the state as well, how important it is to test your home and how important it is to have it mitigated and have safe levels of radon so that this doesn't happen to anyone else. That was very important to my husband, that this not happen to any other family or happen to any other person. So thank you so much.
Thanks for your activism. Don.
Thank you, Mayor Adams and Council, for the proclamation. I'm Don Francis with Ecotech. What we find is that there's just a lot of parts of Portland where half the homes have high radon levels, and that's based upon, I've actually got some information here for each of you from the Oregon Health Division, or now Department of Human Services in Portland State. But as Marlene's pointed out, just because you live in an area where you don't expect to see high radon, any house can have high radon, and that's why the American Lung Association and EPA, Surgeon General Marlene McEwen, all recommend that everybody have their home tested for radon. So I was going to pass out these folders, as well as I have a radon test kit for each of the commissioners, since Mayor Adams already plans on testing his house. And these are valued at less than $25, just so you know. The other thing that I think in helping support preventing all these, most of these lung cancer deaths are unnecessary. Now, that's really frustrating for Marlene, because she lost maybe 20 years, 30 years of a marriage. And just for, you know, something that has a value of less than $25, she would have known there was a problem and fixed it. But there are ways, any way we can help people understand a test and save their lives, there's also ways of doing radon-resistant new construction on buildings and houses. And over in Vancouver, as of about a year and a half ago, there's radon-resistant new building codes so that all residential construction has radon-resistant features so that people aren't basically building new homes with high radon, obviously. So at some point, I'm sure American Lung Association and others will be coming to you and asking for support on that. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
So how can citizens get a hold of these kits?
Well, there's a lot. They're available very easily. American Lung Association website has them. A lot of hardware stores and home improvement stores have do-it-yourself radon test kits. Online, probably type in radon, you know, test, and probably be a bazillion little, you know, markets out there that would come up and sell people test kits.
And then what are the mitigation strategies and how much do they cost?
Good question. Typically, the mitigation strategy is to try to reduce the radon level in the house by keeping it out of the house. There are a number of ways of approaching radon. I'd be glad to talk to you more about that because it would be a long answer. But the most common way is to basically create a vacuum under the foundation of the house and then direct the radon outside. So it's called active soil depressurization. Cost in Portland, $1,500 to $2,100 is probably the average range, with about 90-95% of the houses falling within that. Larger homes, some of their homes are more complex, might be more than that, such as Marlene's was, actually. But you know, relatively affordable to have it done.
So if you'd like to send me a link to amanda@ci.portland.orus, I'll post it on my website so that citizens can find this information.
I will do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I follow up on one question? We had a sewer backup at our house a year or two ago, and I was shocked to learn that my homeowner's insurance covered a portion of the remediation. We had to have people that looked like they were in the NASA program come in these suits and clean the basement, and then there was a connector that had to be dug up and repaired in front of the house. But my homeowner's insurance covered a good portion of the cost to us. I'm wondering whether homeowner insurance policies cover any portion of the remediation for radon.
Want me to take that, or
go for it?
Okay.
Not in our experience. Not.
Yeah, to my knowledge, there's no funding out there for radon mitigation, radon reduction efforts from insurance or federal grants or anything like that. I think it becomes a real issue around low-income housing too, where people probably don't want to test because, you know, $1,500 is much more money than they have. That's another real big issue as far as radon goes and environmental justice and public health.
Thank you.
And when we've talked about this privately, I think it's useful for Portlanders to know that our particular geology has a special vulnerability to radon poisoning. Could you just a few seconds on that so people know that while this is a national issue, we have sort of a special vulnerability locally?
Certainly. The primary source of radon is granite, because granite contains radium. And Commissioner Salton has a background in environmental services and knows this pretty well, probably, too.
I knew that. Yep.
You have a resident on the commission here.
Sure.
Probably elaborate a lot better than I can on this. But so the granites are radium-containing and emit radon as that decays. And Missoula flood deposits from thousands of years ago deposit all the way down from Montana, all the way Portland, Vancouver, down the Willamette Valley, all the way along the Columbia River, these soils and rocks that contain granites, and that's the primary source of radon in this area. And so whenever somebody, that's why all of us have the potential here for having radon in our homes.
Well, thank you all very much. Really appreciate your advocacy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And what's the best way to?
Carla will take them. All right, that gets us to the first item on the council agenda. We have two communications, 9 consent items, and 7 regular items. Carla, could you please read item number 21?
We should do a roll call.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Come to order, please call the roll.
Fish?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Adams?
Here. Now can we call item 21? Mm-hmm.
Request of Roger Widener to address council regarding treatment by the Portland police.
Good morning. Please come to the dais. Give us your name, and you'll have 3 minutes. The time is indicated on that clock in front of you.
Thank you, Mayor. Commissioners. My name is Roger Widener. I'm a former attorney and public prosecutor. In 1975 and 76, I ran the Consumer Fraud Department in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm also a former Portland City fireman. My father was the deputy chief in the Portland City Fire Department. For the last 20 years, I and numerous other citizens around the state have been trying to go into these courts and to put on the record and speak like I'm speaking to you this morning about the criminal conduct of bureaucrats and attorneys, all either licensed or employed by the corporate state of Oregon, stealing people's children and their lands and their property in these sham, often star chamber type proceedings. For trying to speak like I'm speaking to you now in the court, I've been arrested 21 times in all, many times violently, by armed sheriff's deputies, in one case by Portland police officers, for trying to speak like I'm speaking to you about this corruption that's going on in our system. I've been violently arrested twice by Portland police officers in the driveway of my home. Once my 98-year-old father was threatened, my 95-year-old father was threatened with arrest, as was my mother. On another occasion, the Portland police stormed my house with a police dog, drove my 95-year-old mother out of the home, and violently and forcibly arrested her caretaker after macing them in the shower of my home that we've lived in for 70 years. Outrageous conduct by the Portland police. Most recently here, I'm a bicyclist, and I've been out on my bicycle. Twice I was stopped by Officer James. Once on 33rd and Powell Street, I had to get home and relieve myself, and I went against a wait sign. And all of a sudden, I got the red light, and I thought the officer wanted to get by me. When I pulled over, he stopped me, and in a threatening way, he asked me for my identification. I said, it's down at my house. He said, if you go down there, I'll beat you. I said, you're going to beat me? I'll beat you, he said. The same officer, James, and then later when we were in court, I told the judge he gave me a $250 ticket for doing that. And I told the judge, I said, the citizens will not tolerate this kind of treatment by the Portland police. The same officer, James, stopped me again on Woodward Street. I made a turn on my bicycle. He again stopped me, gave me a ticket for doing this. Now, I said, I'm a historian. I'm as knowledgeable can be. In this country, we have a single class of citizens, all equal before the law. And those that are working are divided into two groups, public employees and private employees. And if you're elected or appointed to office, as all of you are, you have a duty to observe the oath of office. Is that my bell? Okay. So what I'm saying is that we, the citizens, are demanding strict observance of your oath of office and that we're treated as we're entitled to be treated. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, sir. Carla, could you please read item number 22?
Request of Sarah Shaul to address council regarding issues with and problems in the business community.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Good morning. If you could just, for the record, give us your name, and you can see the clock, the
yes.
countdown of 3 minutes.
I would like to ask, I know you usually have three spots, and I'm only the second, and I think I'm the last as well. I originally signed up to speak about some items, but something big popped in, and I'm just wondering if I could have a couple more minutes of your time.
Unfortunately, I've got to treat everybody fairly.
That's fine.
I apologize.
So I will try and jam on all this, and I have... some other materials to share with you as well. My name is Sarah Shaul, and I'm a business owner in North Portland. I have a business called Black Wagon. It's a children's boutique. And I employ six people, and I've been a retailer in Portland for 15 years. I have had businesses in Southeast Portland, downtown, and now in North Portland. I'm a member of the Mississippi Business Association. I'm also a member of the I'm now a member of the Small Business Advisory Council, and I also am a counselor for small businesses at the Small Business Development Center. I want to commend you, Mayor Adams, and all you council members for all the work that I see that you're doing to shore up our economy at this time and support small businesses. And I want to say that I am here to step up to help you in any way that I can to help small businesses survive in this economy. My perception is that it's on the street businesses, yoga studios, hair salons, retailers, and restaurants. They're the face of Portland. It's what attracts people. And as you're looking to attract business here to Portland, we really have to make sure that we keep the businesses that are here, make sure that they are surviving and thriving in order to do so. I have a lot of great ideas, some of these would be... to provide direct short-term low-interest capital to keep some businesses operating, provide incentives for employers who add employees and laid off employees back to payroll, and get property owners to the table to talk about how they can be part of the solution as well. I want to switch now to my other issue that I want to talk about, and it's a federal law that goes into effect on February 10th. It's a law that affects the plethora of small businesses here in Portland that cater and sell and produce children's items. Any item that's sold, marketed to a child of the age of 12 and under must be able to test any items that they sell, regardless of if it's a wooden toy made with edible mineral oil or cotton t-shirt. It must be tested. The testing is incredibly expensive, and it'll be a huge negative impact to our local economy. And I do have a position paper here that I can share with you. A group came together, the Northwest Children's Business Alliance. And as the deadline is quickly approaching, we ask for your support and help in asking for more time, and so this law is not enforced as on February 10th, and for more time for testimony and improvements to this law. I'm sure it's well intended, but it's poorly thought through.
So I'm Skip from my offices here to talk with you more about this, and I'm actually heading back for a U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting on Friday, and then lobbying our federal delegation. I'm happy to. If you'll give us the sort of the talking points in the background, I'm happy to lobby on your behalf and other small businesses' behalf in D.C. next week.
So, Sarah, you do only have 3 minutes to testify, but we actually get to ask you questions.
Okay.
And then you have another opportunity to clarify. So I'm just curious on the specifics of the federal regulation. What specifically is it that caused your concerns?
I'm sorry?
You said there was a federal regulation
yes.
relating to children's toys. What
yes.
specifically does that do that raises concerns for you?
Well, this law, it was an answer to a lot of toys made in China that had high lead levels.
I see.
This law is overreaching. It applies to all items made for children. There has been no instances of items made in the U.S., the EU, or Canada that have had any issues with lead affecting children. The law is just overreaching. There are the testing is the testing is very expensive, and it's going to put a lot of businesses out of business on February 10th. It's retroactive, so that means Goodwill can't sell children's items unless they can afford to test. Testing can be hundreds of dollars per item. So, I mean, it's going to really affect the local economy.
So can I follow up on Commissioner Leonard's question? Because I was in Finnegan's the other day buying a robot for my five-year-old, and I noticed that the toy had a lot of disclaimers on it. One was a suggested age range. Another one was any hazards that a parent need to be advised of. But are you telling us that under the new federal law, it is the retailer's responsibility and not the manufacturer's responsibility to do the testing?
At every level, actually. Well, the retailers, there must be a document of certification for these items. So going forward, if you produce an item without certification of compliance, you can be levied a fine of about $100,000. And that's per item. So you have small crafters who make quilts. That would affect them. For a retailer like myself, my store is already full of merchandise. So I would be required to test any items that I already have in my store or that I purchase from a quilter. Somebody like, because it's retroactive, to any items, like a store like Goodwill would have to have everything tested themselves.
Well, I can imagine that also with some of the micro enterprises that the city funds, their Economic Opportunity Initiative, where people do crafts and toys for children that are handmade, this could have a very detrimental impact. So look forward to finding out what the mayor learns in his trip to D.C.
Wonderful.
Thanks for your work. Appreciate it. All right, we have nine items on the consent agenda, items number 23 through 31. Is there anyone on council that wishes to pull an item from the consent agenda? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to pull an item from the consent agenda? Carla, has anyone notified us of an interest to pull an item?
I do not have any.
All right. Call the roll, please.
Fish?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. That gets us to council agenda item number 32. Could you please read the title?
Repeal the limit on the annual cumulative value of new projects that apply for a tax exemption under the new transit supportive residential or mixed-use development program so new transit-oriented multifamily projects can move forward, creating new jobs to stimulate the Portland area economy.
Commissioner Nick Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor Adams, yesterday you led the council in a press conference to unveil an economic stimulus plan, which was designed to pump up the local economy by accelerating a number of shovel-ready projects and making some other changes in the law, which will put our people back to work. As part of the comprehensive proposal, we are today addressing one component of your plan. And since you requested immediate action, we thought 24 hours was appropriate.
Good job, Commissioner Fish. I like it.
Spoken like a former fire commissioner.
There you go. The council today will be presented with a proposal to lift the cap on the aggregate amount of tax abatement that can be granted in any calendar year for what we call the transit-oriented development abatement. And very simply, this is our abatement which creates incentives for people to develop affordable housing along transit corridors. It has a number of benefits. One is it puts density where we want it, which is in town centers and along transportation corridors. Number two, it is a tool, a tax abatement, which complements a number of other tools that we have, including zoning changes, general fund money, tax increment financing, and a host of other tools which create incentives to facilitate private sector development of housing which meets our social goals. The proposal that we are presenting to you lifts the cap, which is $20 million in the aggregate for the year. That means that a number of shovel-ready projects that are either in the pipeline or that have been proposed could be fast-tracked under this proposal. However, I want to just make something very clear to my colleagues. We are not proposing that any particular tax abatement be granted today, and the Council, in approving this, would in no way be altering our current system, which is that the Council must approve a tax abatement for it to apply to any particular project. All we are asking for today is the additional flexibility to put more projects in the pipeline and approve more abatements to incentivize housing under the TOD program. I have communicated with Chair Wheeler to let him know that we are taking this up and have assured him that in doing so, we are not coupling this with any action to approve any project. And under the protocol that we've established with the county, we, of course, confer with them about our abatement decisions because of the foregone revenue impact on all of our sister jurisdictions, including the county. And before I introduce our distinguished panel, I just want to remind my colleagues that this proposal falls on the heels of the first annual report which you've received on tax abatements, which was presented to you in October, the first time that the Council actually received a comprehensive look at how all the city's tax abatements work, including tallying up all the foregone revenue to both the city and to all of our jurisdictions. We intend to continue to do this in an open and transparent way, and today we're seeking to modify one particular abatement to give us some more flexibility and hopefully put some more shovel-ready projects into the pipeline. I'd like to turn it over now to Keith Witkowski and Barbara Sack, who will lead us briefly through what we're proposing and answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Well, Keith Witkowski, Government Relations, Portland Development Commission. Commissioner, you did a great job of laying out exactly what's happening today, so my comments are very limited. Right now, we do have two projects that are very likely interested in using the transit-oriented development abatement to move ahead. One is Killingsworth Station, which is an affordable project at Killingsworth and Interstate. We'd expect it back to begin moving forward March, April of this year. If this is approved, obviously the project again would come back to you for approval upon financial analysis from PDC and policy analysis from planning. The other project is the 119, which is out at 119th and East Burnside. So those are the two likely candidates.
And this might, either Commissioner Fish Mr. Witkowski, the work that you have initiated to make sure that the abatements in the future, the provisions of the individual agreements are held to, if you could give us, one of you give us or somebody give us a quick overview of the auditor was very critical of the monitoring in place. If you could talk a little bit about the work underway to get on top of that.
So if I could frame it, and then I'll ask you to address it. Mayor, this council, you, Commissioner Leonard, and others, and the auditor in the past have correctly insisted that once a tax abatement is granted, that there be accountability to make sure that the project continues to be eligible for the abatement. And that is to make sure that the affordability guidelines are being met, that the folks in the units are paying the appropriate rent, and that the other limitations that we put in place are observed. In response to those requests, PDC and the Bureau of Planning have substantially overhauled their monitoring processes. That will be part of our annual report. You'll recall that in October in the report, we actually identified a number of projects that no longer qualified for tax abatements, both single family and multifamily. The Council voted to take away the abatements because they no longer qualified. Commissioner Leonard made some very specific recommendations of ways that we could beef up our oversight by seeking additional documentation from the property owners and using independent audits of their books and records so that we had confidence that the numbers we were getting were accurate. That's the.
If I could just narrow in on that a little bit, specifically in 2004, well, just to kind of give a backdrop as I know everybody here understands, but those listening may not, when we award a tax abatement, it's based on an application made by the developer that basically gives us a prospectus that would indicate that without the abatement, they can't afford to do the project. So, of course, from their perspective, they're always going to argue that they need the most amount of assistance as possible, and I understand that. On our side, however, to address the point that you raised, in 2004, the council adopted a policy that I think rather cleanly gets to the integrity of those applications by simply requiring that annually the property owner then submit a financial statement as opposed to an audit, but actually as a condition of the continued abatement, that they give us an actual financial statement that reflects, in fact, how the property performed versus how they projected it would perform. And then based on that, we decide whether or not the abatement is necessary. And if based on the financial statement it is, it continues. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And or some percentage. I mean, it could be. It was always interesting to me that developers, when asking for abatement, never asked for a 7-year 62% abatement of property tax, but always 10 years, the full amount, which is suspicious to me. So so I'm hoping that specific provision is part of this deal.
No, it is. And that was that's something that's been put in our agreements. I think I submitted some copies of that a few months ago when we had the conversation at council, where it clearly states that those are requirements if you're going to get a tax abatement, or as we're calling it now, a tax investment. From the city, then you have to submit those materials annually.
Okay.
And that's important, Commissioner Leonard, because you know, when you made your comments in our October hearing, staff reported that, in fact, the law and the code had been changed to reflect this as a requirement. You made the further suggestion that it should actually be set forth in the agreements that we strike
right.
with the developers, so it's very clear to them that this is a requirement and gives us an additional tool to potentially cancel the deal. And that has been incorporated into our agreements with landlords.
I would just say I've never, you know, this has been a touchy subject. I would never argue to simply cancel the deal. The point being that if they are actually making enough money to justify not having the abatement, then it's wasted money. My fear in the past has been we haven't been as focused and as targeted when agreeing to abatements as we could be, and thus my standard is, does an abatement cause a project to happen that otherwise would not have happened? And I'm not sure that's always been the case. I think if we're a little more vigilant, and thus the county's concerns and that are legitimate concerns, I mean, I think they argue the same thing, that it isn't that we blanket don't support abatements, but we want to make sure that we're giving them where we're causing things to happen and not just piling on extra cash to a developer that would do the development anyway.
Or would do the, and I would just add, associate with those comments and also add that either that the project be done with a level of affordability.
Exactly.
We are basically buying with mm-hmm. the abatement. So I think the reforms that have been made in the short time that you've been housing commissioner on this sort of whole waterfront of abatement issues have been absolutely necessary and incredibly assertive and constructive. Did you have anything more?
No.
Barbara?
I can answer any questions about the history of why we had this cap. I don't know if council members are interested in that.
Why did we have this cap, Barbara?
Back in 2005 and 2006, the council was reviewing the city's multifamily tax exemption programs. There's one that's an incentive for multifamily housing in the central city and urban renewal areas, and then the TOD programs available outside the central city. There had been some council had questioned the need for the central city program since a lot of housing was being built in the central city, and that program was suspended. We basically haven't accepted applications under the central city program since about 2005, except for 100% low-income projects. The council then looked at the TOD program, and at the time we expanded the boundaries of the TOD program quite a bit and made some other changes to the code, including mandatory affordability. Originally, the TOD program was adopted to support the light rail system, and the east-west light rail lines station areas were covered by the TOD program. Since that time, we had built the yellow line, and we had plans to build the green line. So in 2006, we added in the yellow line stations, the planned green line stations, one of the red line stations up towards the airport, and we also added the area on MLK between Lombard and Schuller Street to the program. So we were greatly expanding the program. Since council had been concerned about foregone revenue, we thought, well, maybe we should put a cap on the improvement values of projects that could come in any given year. The average for the first 9 years of the program was projects totaling about $10 million a year had come in. So since we had expanded the boundaries, we doubled that figure and proposed $20 million to be the cap for the first 3 years, and then council could set another cap for the next 3 years.
Barbara, I just want to say that since I just understood what you said, which is something of a miracle, I compliment you on the succinct way that you expressed it. And you mentioned foregone revenue. So for the benefit of people listening, I just want to make a point on that because it dovetails nicely with Commissioner Leonard's point.
Right.
Foregone revenue is the money that we do not collect in taxes because we grant a limited tax abatement. And this is our way of helping a developer meet what we've identified as a social need, in this case, housing for among our poorest citizens. We know that housing for low-income people requires a subsidy. The private market cannot do it because it doesn't pencil out. Well, we facilitate that kind of housing by changing our zoning, like what we did recently in the River District to create family-friendly housing.
And interstate.
We do it by using our federal subsidies. We do it by using tax increment financing money. We do it through bond efforts, all kinds of tools. This is just another tool in our kit. But I want to make one thing very clear. When we talk about foregone revenue, it has to be viewed also in the context of, in the absence of us encouraging and incentivizing this kind of development, it would not happen.
That's right.
So it's foregone revenue, but against the backdrop of we would never have had the revenue if we didn't use some tool in our kit to help develop it. So therein is the sort of catch-22.
I very much appreciate you making that point, because when the program is run vigilantly and efficiently with an eye on making sure we're protecting the taxpayer, it runs exactly the way you've described it. My concern in the past was that we weren't running it so tight that we were actually not getting revenue we would otherwise get. And I think Commissioner Fish's approach, and I just can't tell you how much I appreciate you articulating your vision for how this program should run, matches my goal as well, just to make sure we're doing things, making things happen that would otherwise not happen. And then it's truly not foregone revenue.
Go ahead.
A couple questions. First of all, why repeal the limit altogether? Why not just replace it with a new limit?
This is the only program that has a cap on it, the TOD program, and it is actually, in terms of foregone revenue, one of the smaller programs. We were hoping that the annual reporting would replace the cap on this particular program, because every year, council, we get to look at the foregone revenue and the program outcomes for all the programs and then decide to make some sort of adjustment.
But if I could interrupt, what we've also talked about is that Commissioner Fish has talked about in our work groups is that as each individual project comes forward during the course of the year, we would also get sort of the aggregate to date in terms of what other projects have been approved and what's been the aggregate abatement up to consideration of the new project.
So rather than set an arbitrary figure above the $20 million, what we wanted is to give the council the opportunity to make that judgment. And if, for example, Commissioner Saltzman, if we get to $25 million and you think that that's about what where we should be in terms of an overall cap, then as a soft cap, then the council at that point could say no more abatements or could reject any application. We will provide to you the aggregate amount with each project that comes before council.
And then secondly, the potential foregone revenues to the city and the county. I realize you have two projects here specifically mentioned. What would be, if those projects come to reality, what would be the foregone revenues to the city and the county from those two projects?
If council approves these projects when they come to you, you're looking at probably $500,000 between the two projects, if you assume about $40 million in improvement value. To the county, you know, they're like 25% of it.
So half million each? Or
half million total.
Okay.
Total.
To the
city? Annually.
Okay.
Cross
the city,
county,
everybody.
Education, city. County shares about $130,000 a year if these two projects are approved. So the city shares.
And one thing, the flip side of that, Mayor, because you made the point yesterday, is just to put that in context, if we were in this calendar year to agree to, say, $25 million of construction within the TOD program, that's 200 construction jobs and 6 permanent jobs and a tremendous amount of stimulus to the economy and a multiplier effect.
especially in that neighborhood.
In neighborhoods that where we need to put people back to work and generate some activity. So while there's a foregone revenue during the 10-year period, because these are circumscribed by the first 10 years, there is, in the short term, an enormous multiplier to our local economy and putting people back to work.
The other reform that will be coming forward out of the work with Commissioner Fish on the budget, and it's also inspired by the concerns that we've had in the past, I think all of us as well have had in the past, and that is that during in the budget process ahead and hopefully forevermore, just like we book investments in affordable housing, as Commissioner Fish mentioned, from tax increment in the budget, it shows up in the budget, or from general fund resources. There's no place in the city's budget where we book the investments from tax abatements. And so we've been talking as well about in the budget, the city's budget, we would on an annual basis show the investments by way of tax abatements for specific projects. And we will book those as expenditures, which is your point, exactly what they are, another tool of expenditures to buy down the cost of housing or make sure that housing is built in specific places. Now, the reason why this is exciting for me, or why I support this additionally, is the fact that land prices tend to go up, especially around light rail stations. The place that we need to have affordable housing is, should be very accessible to light rail, very accessible to transit. So this helps ensure affordability in the places that we need it most, around transit stops.
And I appreciate that comment, Mayor, because as you noted also yesterday, and Commissioner Leonard noted, with an annual inflation factor of about 6% in construction, there might be someone in the community who says, well, why do we need this program? Let's just wait 2 or 3 years for blue skies and hope that the economy turns around, the credit markets brighten, and a miracle happens and someone finds the financing. Well, the problem is we have a crushing need for this kind of housing in our community. And with a little bit of jump-starting from the city, we can actually encourage the private sector to step up and meet our social goals. And that's what we're trying to do today.
Any other conversation or questions from council or our staff panel? If not, do we have anyone signed up to testify on this?
We do. We have three people.
Please call them.
Gordon Jones, Chris Rogers, and Andy Kelly. Please come on up.
Oh, you're so close to the door. I thought you were grabbing for that. Good morning. Please come forward. Take a seat. All you need is to give us your name and keep an eye on that clock. Your comments are of 3 minutes. Who would like to go first?
I'm Gordon Jones. excuse me. Address is 9837 Northeast Irving Street. Been developing transit oriented high-density housing for a number of years out in the Gateway area primarily. The 119 project that was mentioned is a project that we have proposed. Briefly, the reasons that the cap has become an issue for us is it makes planning very difficult. PDC has been unwilling to approve our applications far enough in advance that we know that we're going to be able to move forward with the project. There's so much uncertainty in the system now that you just don't dare go forward on a project that you're planning on having tax abatement approved for without the certainty that you have it. Lenders are looking at that. Equity is looking at that. So that's been an issue. Another issue is that In planning for increased density around light rail stations, you can, with the tax abatement, it incentivizes a greater density in the housing that you design. However, when you begin the design process, if you don't know whether or not you're going to be able to get the tax abatement, the incentive is to, well, maybe assume you aren't going to be able to get it because the cap is going to be used up, perhaps. So you would tend to design something that's a lower density because you might not have the tax abatement, and you might be able to make that work. For example, where our project is located, we could, under the zoning, do a three-story woody walk-up. that's allowed. But we've designed a five-story, much higher density building. But that design was counting on having the Todd tax abatement. So.
Thank you very much. Hi.
Hi, Andy Kelly. I'm Gordon's partner in the 119. He and I collectively have additional sites out between 205 and the city limits on the east side. I have a site on 102nd Avenue that we just withdrew our design review request because we weren't sure if we were going to get our tax abatement. I've got another site out by the 148th Avenue Station that we're redesigning from our typical 4 or 5 story project to a 3-story woody walk-up, again, for the same reason. So the uncertainty of not knowing if you can meet objective standards to get the tax abatement because of the cap is forcing us to do lower density.
Thank you very much. Hi.
Hi. My name is Chris Rogers. I'm a small-time developer here in Portland, and I own a piece of property on Northwest 20th and Pettigrove. The property is located in a transit-oriented district. I'm currently planning an approximately $11 million project that would provide 90 units of housing on the site. The issue I'd like to talk about is number one, obviously with the cap, that one project would eliminate half of the available Todd tax abatement credits out there. So needless to say, there very few projects could be accomplished in the city of Portland if the cap were to remain in place. In addition to that, one of the elements of the Todd cap that you talked about was affordable housing. And I think it's important to note, especially in the Northwest Portland area, there's a very large gap between what the city designates as affordable housing, which I believe is 60% of median income, and what market housing is. And just to make the numbers simple, if you were to look at a one-person household in downtown Portland who is at the 60% of median income level, the way the rents work out is somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 a month. If you were to go to a market level, it's closer to $1,700, $1,800 a month. You know, when you deal with a lot of these condo projects that have turned over into rental properties and whatnot. So there's a very large gap between what I would call market rate and what I would call, or what the city would call affordable rate. One of my goals on this particular site was to satisfy that demand of a very large population, I believe, that is in need of housing in the downtown area that falls in that gap, you know, more towards the $500 range, but certainly not up to the market level of the $1,700, $1,800 range. So I think when I went down and talked to PDC about the possibility of obtaining a tax abatement, one of the points they mentioned was that it's unlikely that you're going to get abatements unless you provide 100% affordable housing. And what I wanted to say to you was that in and of itself could really, even with the tax abatements, could really prevent the project from happening. And I think that, you know, it's a great site downtown. It provides lots of jobs. There's a real need for housing down there. So I think just the Todd tax abatements are just one facet of the ability to move a project like that forward. And we all know that the climate for financing has changed, certainly in the last 4 months. And I think that's another issue, maybe another discussion. But I see my time's up, so I'll leave it at that.
If I could, I appreciate the suggestions that you're making to council about ways of fine-tuning the Todd program. And one of the benefits of an annual review process is that we can consider all kinds of constructive changes that, sure, that meet the city's housing goals, that also make the program more efficient. So thank you for that, and we'll certainly consider your thoughts.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate your time coming to City Council.
So I guess it's not for you.
Oh, okay.
I guess I want to know specifically, what is the approval of the county for what we're doing here today? Do we have a specific
letter from Ted Chair Wheeler saying the county is in support of this, or what?
So I spoke to Chair Wheeler personally and advised him that we were moving forward with this, and that because it was not coupled with any specific tax abatement that we were granting, we were simply giving ourselves more flexibility in the future to review additional applications. And he was comfortable with that. The agreement we have with the county is that when it comes to the time when we actually are asked to grant a tax abatement, that we confer with the county. And I am scheduled, Commissioner, on January 29th to go before the firing squad at the county. I'll be doing the first annual presentation of our tax abatement report to the county commissioners and engaging them. So he has been notified. He has no objection to us going forward with the understanding that we're not actually granting an abatement under this change.
And I would just add that as we make that report, that just as you've characterized it here, Commissioner Fish, these are the council-approved investments in a specific type of affordable housing project that that is part of what we indicate in our budget. We should also indicate the foregone revenue from the county, and that represents their investment in affordable housing, for which a part of their mission includes homeless programs and affordable housing programs. Anybody else signed up to testify?
That was all signed up.
Is anyone else in the room that would like to testify on this matter? All right, not seeing anybody. Will you please call the roll?
Fish?
Well, this is part of the mayor's economic stimulus package, which I think is farsighted.
City council.
Excuse me. Proposed by the mayor, supported with the support of the city council. I'm pleased that the council is out front in trying to mitigate and address the impacts of this dismal economy. This is just one piece of a complex puzzle that we hope will lead to enhanced economic activity on the ground. And this may very well give us the flexibility to support a number of shovel-ready projects that otherwise would not fall within this program. In approving this change today, we are giving ourselves additional flexibility to consider new investments in transit-oriented development, but we are not binding the council to any particular decision. I'm pleased to vote aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Leonard?
Well, I think that any reasonable skeptic of tax abatements hearing Commissioner Fish's articulation how he intends to administer this program should resolve any reasonable concerns. It certainly does mine, and I'm very pleased to support this and really very happy with how Commissioner Fish has articulated that he will administer this program. Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Well, I want to commend Commissioner Fish for his skillful and fresh perspective to all of our housing efforts, and this is just another example. Thank you. Aye.
Neglected to thank Barbara and Keith for their good work. Thanks again, team.
All right, that gets us to council item number 33. Could you please read the title? Sorry.
Approve appointment of David Widmark and reappointment of Nathan Teske to the Housing Authority of Portland Board of Commissioners.
Are either individuals here? Would you like to come forward? Commissioner Fish?
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor, we are moving two nominations to the Housing Authority Board today. One is for Nathan Teske, which is a reappointment, and the second is David Widmark. Mr. Widmark is a city councilor from Gresham. I met with him recently, and I have to tell you, given his background, which includes service on the City Planning Commission, and a wide range of community activities, and I believe this is his third stint on the city council, so he's a glutton for punishment. I will just say personally that we have in the past, from time to time, struggled to get people who would make the commitment from Gresham to serve on the board, and there's two dedicated positions on the HAP board. It's almost unprecedented to have a city commissioner, a city councilor, a volunteer for this position. It bodes well for our relationship with HAP because it brings Gresham more dynamically into the decision-making process. And I want to just publicly thank Mr. Widmark for his willingness to take on this assignment. He is joined today by Jeff Bachrach, who was just elected to his third term as chair of the Housing Authority of Portland. King Jeff, apparently there's no term limits at the Housing Authority. Mr. Widmark, by tradition, we would invite you to make a few comments to the council.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Mayor and Commissioners, it's an honor to be nominated for this. My mayor, Shane Bemis, asked me specifically if I would consider doing this because of my experiences. This is actually my fourth time to serve on the council, twice as fill-in and twice to be elected, and just recently was elected to another four-year term. Housing and issues related around that are extremely important to me. It was an issue I ran on for affordable housing, also living wage jobs, providing those opportunities that we have, particularly in East County. And I don't look at this position as just looking at it from Gresham's standpoint. I look at it from a county standpoint, but particularly focused on the East County. I think we have a lot of opportunities to partner with the City of Portland, particularly where we have a large boundary and projects on both sides that we could work together with. And I look at it as an honor to serve on the HAP Commission. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Councillor, for your willingness to do this and keep doing this. It's more important than ever.
Thank you.
Jeff, would you like to say a word?
If Council will indulge me, I rarely get a chance to be in front of you, I like to take advantage of it, and even though this is not directly with Mr. Widmark's appointment, I have two quick comments. I'll take a New York minute to go through. And one, I'd like to congratulate particularly Mayor Adams and Commissioner Fish on the bold plan to reorganize the city's housing delivery system. I think it won't be easy as you take the disparate pieces and put them together into one new bureau, but I think the end product will be worth it. I think you got a little of that sample of that today in the prior conversation where there are different programs serving different rungs on the affordable housing ladder, and I think to have a centralized policy center and development center and lending center that can kind of focus on a coherent policy will be beneficial to the community at large and certainly the affordable housing community. So I thank you for taking that task on. And I would say HAP and its staff stands ready, willing, and able to help in that, but I know Commissioner Fish has already taken advantage of that offer, so I don't really need to repeat it, but I know some of our staff is already working closely with your staffs to see how this new entity can work best. The other quick comment I'd like to make is I hope to be back in front of you. I strongly hope to be back in front of you in 2 weeks when you will be hopefully approving the documentation for the Resource Access Center. HAP's already working on that project, but we're ahead of sort of the intergovernmental agreements and the documentation, and we're anxiously awaiting that delivery to you for your approval in 2 weeks. So I hope I'm back here in 2 weeks when you will take a look at where we're at on the Resource Access Center and hopefully approve it. So thank you for indulging me on sort of those HAP comments, and we're delighted to have Mr. Widmark hopefully joining our commission. Thank you.
Mayor, if you would indulge me just for a moment, I want to embarrass Jeff Bachrach publicly.
Jeff, he tries. You're not going to succeed, Nick. I know more about you than you know about me. So.
I thought that was covered. By attorney.
Can I buy you coffee afterwards?
I thought that was covered by attorney-client privilege. Jeff has a daughter, Hannah Bachrach, who is a sophomore in Lincoln. And last night, throughout the state of Oregon, there was a competition called the We the People program, which is the civics program in our public schools, sponsored by the United States Department of Education, and it selects
Grant High School wins year after year.
It is the first round which selects the teams to go to the finals.
Yes.
And I think in a couple of weeks the finals will be held at the Marco Hatfield Courthouse, and a distinguished panel of judges will be judging it. Historically, Grant and Lincoln have vied for state honors and then have gone to the Nationals. One of those teams has gone to the Nationals and historically done very well, typically top five nationally. Last night, Hannah's team won the top award for their congressional district, which is David Wu's district. Grant won the top award for Earl Blumenauer's congressional district. Lake Oswego was the top awardee in that congressional district. But as wonderful as that is, we come to expect Grant and Lincoln to be among the very best. And they have tremendous programs with coaches and lots of support. Mayor, you chose Park Rose High School for your swearing in. Park Rose High School has not historically been a big player in the We the People program. And only recently has the principal made a commitment to really make sure the kids have the resources they need. Last night, Park Rose did exceptionally well, and I'm told by points just fell short of Grant's total points within the congressional district. But six awards were given for the top performers in each unit that was part of the United's